or the relationship between them and the rest of the United States that could change this? Is there a prospect? Is there a plan that could work?
Oh yeah, I think there are plans that could work for sure. I mean, first of all, you know, Puerto Rico is pretty small. You're talking about just over 3 million people, and so it wouldn't be that hard for the U.S. federal government to arrange a plan that will allow them to restart growth right away, and to have a real economic recovery. They're not doing it. And I think, you know, there is at least some base here. Obviously, there are millions of Puerto Ricans in the U.S. There are members of Congress that do care about this. They're in a minority, but they're there. And so there will be, I hope, some more fights over this. But no, it's not that hard to come up with a plan that would restore economic growth and allow them to adjust to some of these changes in the U.S. and international economy that have thrown them into this crisis.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there, but it really is a tragic situation, and we're going to keep watching it. We thank you for taking the time out. We've been speaking with Mark Weisbrot. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Mark, for joining us on Flashpoints.
Sure. Thank you.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Report from Kabul speech by Zahair Wahab on Wednesday, July 26th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House in Portland. Zahair Wahab, a native of Afghanistan and director of graduate studies at the American University of Afghanistan, will present a critical analysis of the Afghani political, military, economic, and cultural situation. Again, that's Report from Kabul by Zahair Wahab on Wednesday, July 26th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, 4312 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 11:02 a.m. and coming up next on Between the Lines Radio, they'll be examining the Presidential Commission on Election Integrity, which they call a GOP Trojan horse to expand voter suppression. Let's get right to it. But before we get right to it, I am honored, privileged, as well as contractually obligated to remind you that this KBOO program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Chamber Music Northwest, featuring the 2017 Summer Festival starting June 26th. 5 weeks of chamber music, over 30 concerts, more than 60 artists and ensemble, 8 world premieres, 2 theatrical experiences, and a celebration of women composers that spans 9 centuries. More information is available at cmnw.org. And now, as promised, this is Between the Lines Radio.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Tomas Lopez of the Brennan Center for Justice, who discusses his concern that President Trump's Commission on Election Integrity may be a Trojan horse, established to usher in more restrictive voter suppression laws. Stanley Heller of the Middle East Crisis Committee, who assesses the effect of Israel's deliberate power blackout imposed on the people of Gaza, as requested by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. and Dr. Susan Rogers of the group Physicians for a National Health Program, who examines provisions in the now-dead second version of the Senate GOP healthcare bill and reflects on the campaign advocating for a single-payer universal healthcare system. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
British American Tobacco, one of the largest cigarette makers in the world, has threatened numerous governments in Africa, including Kenya and Uganda, for advocating public health measures to limit tobacco consumption. London-based BAT, which is taking over U.S. tobacco giant Reynolds American, sees Africa as a growth market with rising numbers of young people. According to the Guardian newspaper, BAT lawyers in Kenya have filed legal papers opposing anti-smoking regulations and increased taxes. In Uganda, BAT attorneys say the government's Tobacco Control Act is unconstitutional. Many nations in Africa have signed the World Health Organization's Treaty on Tobacco Control and are now developing tobacco regulations. Tobacco kills 7 million people across the globe annually. There currently are an estimated 77 million smokers in Africa, with dramatic increases in smoking expected in Cameroon and Sierra Leone. Thus far, BAT has succeeded in delaying tobacco regulations in Kenya for 15 years. The company is also working to influence Kenya's upcoming parliamentary elections this August. In the face of the Trump administration's cutoff of family planning funding, the international community's drive to provide modern contraception for millions of poor women has fallen behind. 5 years ago, global public health leaders pledged to provide contraception to 120 million women and girls by 2020. But thus far, only 30 million women have received contraception assistance. The global campaign was designed to reduce mortality at childbirth and address concerns over burgeoning population growth in poor nations, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. In a northern Nigerian clinic, midwives provide injectable contraceptives to young women in an area not far from where Boko Haram terrorists operate. The contraceptives prevent women from getting pregnant for up to 4 years. Yet the community clinic in Nigeria may soon close due to the Trump administration's imposition of the so-called Global Gag Rule, which bans U.S. aid to groups that provide abortions. The United Nations Population Fund now faces a $700 million budget deficit, hindering provision of contraceptives to impoverished nations over the next 3 years. The African Union recently held a summit meeting on the issue of surging population growth on the continent. By the end of the century, Nigeria's population could quadruple to 800 million people. Downtown Detroit has a shiny new streetcar transit system funded by large foundations. It's seen by many observers as a sign of a comeback for the Motor City amid a downtown property boom and construction of new sports stadiums. But the privately run transit service ends at the Amtrak station and offers no help to most Detroit residents who don't own cars and find it difficult to travel to jobs in the suburbs. Despite the downtown turnaround, Detroit continues to lose residents. From a peak of 1.8 million in 1950, only 670,000 people remain, mostly African Americans, who live in a city of 139 square miles, the size of Manhattan, Boston, and San Francisco combined. 70,000 Detroit residents have had their water service cut off since 2014, and thousands remain at risk of foreclosure. After years of decline, many Detroit residents have adapted to life without access to cash or credit. As In These Times reports, an informal economy has sprung up through barter, gifts, and time trading, and off-the-books enterprises including beauty salons in basements, auto repair shops in back alleys, and restaurants run out of homes. According to activist anthropologist David Graeber, author of Debt, The First 5,000 Years, bartering has long been a survival strategy when traditional economies fall apart. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Donald Trump's Electoral College victory in the November presidential election surprised most political pollsters and the majority of voters who had supported Hillary Clinton. Clinton won the popular vote by nearly 3 million ballots, which caused a frustrated Trump to repeatedly make the false claim that 3 to 5 million illegal immigrants had voted for the Democratic candidate. On the basis of this false accusation, designed to provide a rationale for his historic popular vote loss, Trump initiated the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity to investigate alleged fraudulent voting. The commission is chaired by Vice President Mike Pence, and Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach serves as vice chair. Kobach is well known as the architect of voter suppression laws adopted by states across the country, as well as Arizona's infamous anti-immigrant papers please law, SB 1070. On behalf of the commission, Kobach requested voter information from all 50 state governments in late June. However, the request for voters' names, addresses, birth dates, party affiliation, and the last four digits of Social Security numbers was refused outright by 19 states, with others unwilling to comply with key parts of the request. Democratic legislators have demanded Kobach be fired, and four lawsuits have been filed against the commission for violation of various federal laws. Your reporter spoke with Tomas Lopez, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program, who discusses his concern that the commission may be a Trojan horse established to usher in more restrictive voter suppression laws for partisan political advantage.
Last fall, both prior to the election and after the election, President Trump made a number of statements about widespread voter fraud being a concern, and then, you know, an actual thing that he alleges happened in last year's election. He claimed that 3 to 5 million people voted illegally in the 2016 presidential election, but I can tell you that there's no evidence to back that up. Our concern is that this commission that has been set up with Kris Kobach as chair, and then also a number of the other leading individuals with a long history supporting voting restrictions, we're worried that what they're going to be doing is trying to justify these claims of widespread voter fraud, and then also forwarding an agenda, we fear, to call for voting restrictions around the country, more aggressive voter purges, and generally take a big step backward in voting rights.
Tell our listeners exactly what is Kris Kobach and this presidential commission asking the state governments for? What type of information are they after?
Sure. So a couple of weeks ago, Secretary Kobach sent a letter to all 50 states that asked that, them to provide voter data on name, date of birth, the last four digits of a Social Security number, felony conviction history, whether or not they voted in elections going back to 2006, a whole ream of information, a lot of which many states don't even allow to be released. This information, we now understand, especially after statements that have been made, it seems as if the commission intends to try to compare this giant list that they would get of 200 million American voters if every state produces data to federal government databases to try to come up with some kind of alleged list of potential non-citizens that are on the voter rolls or people registered to vote in multiple states and use that information to attempt to justify voting restrictions at the federal level.
Tomas, what has been the response of state governments across the country to this request for voter information from Kris Kobach and this commission?
What we have seen is that states have largely rebuffed this request and that they have done so across partisan lines. There are over 20 states that in one way or another have declined either to provide any data at all or have imposed some really tough conditions on the commission before that data is being released. There are some states that are providing data that the state is claiming is not shielded by law. And what we're seeing is that across the political spectrum, election officials are not really happy with this request. And so, yes, you have some Democrats, like you might expect, that are questioning the motives of the commission, questioning why they're asking for this, for such personal data. But you also had the Secretary of State of Mississippi come out and tell the commission they could go jump in the Gulf of Mexico. They've exposed an issue that I think touches a nerve for voters, for officials, and for people across party lines.
What are the checks and balances on this commission and their work? If indeed their mission is to further voter suppression across the country, what force in Congress or in civil society in general can challenge that?
One of the things that is important to understand is that this commission does not have subpoena power. This commission can't force the states to do anything, can't force others to do anything. It doesn't have legislative power, but it does have a really big platform by being created by a presidential executive order, by having the imprimatur and the legitimacy that comes from being a presidential commission. You know, this is not something that should be taken lightly. Our concerns, and I think the concerns that voters and election officials are expressing about what this body is doing, they don't come from nowhere. Chris Kobach is getting a lot of attention, but he's not the only person on this commission who gives us concern. Hans von Spakovsky, another member, in many ways is the intellectual godfather of the effort that we've seen in recent years to pass restrictive voting laws around the country. J. Christian Adams is a former Department of Justice attorney who in recent years has brought a series of lawsuits attempting to force states and localities to more aggressively purge voters so that they can, in such a way that you end up taking eligible voters off the rolls. And J. Kenneth Blackwell, the former Secretary of State of Ohio, is somebody who had a long track record when he was running elections in that state of both troubled administration and of putting together rules that made it more difficult for people to cast a ballot.
That was Tomas Lopez, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program. Learn more about challenges to voter suppression laws and the Presidential Commission on Election Integrity by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Israel has conducted three military invasions of the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian territory controlled by Hamas since 2008. Gaza has been under an Israeli military blockade since 2006, after Hamas defeated the other major Palestinian political party, Fatah, which exerts some control over the West Bank, though Israel is ultimately in control of both territories. In June of this year, the conflict between the two Palestinian factions escalated. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas asked Israel to impose restrictions on electric power that Israel delivers to Gaza. The situation is truly desperate for the 2 million people living in the third most densely populated geographic area in the world, who are without electricity for most of the day. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Stanley Heller, who founded the Middle East Crisis Committee 35 years ago to address the issues of the Israel-Palestinian conflict and the role played by the U.S. In 2003, he began producing The Struggle, a half-hour weekly video news program that now runs on public access stations from northern Vermont to New Jersey. Heller recently produced his 700th show. Here he discusses the power blackout imposed on the people of Gaza and how his show has broadened its coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in recent years to address relevant environmental concerns.
In the middle of June, the Palestinian Authority, believe it or not, Mahmoud Abbas, its boss, goes to Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, and says, cut the electricity going to Gaza 40%. Now, at this point, Gaza gets all its electricity from Israel. The last power plant that had been bombed by Israel and somewhat restored ran out of fuel, couldn't afford the fuel. And so it stopped. So all the electricity was coming from Israel. Abbas says, cut it back because Hamas is not doing what I want. And Netanyahu did it. Now, of course, he didn't have to. He rarely does anything Abbas wants, but he did this. And so it's pitiful. There's a woman I've interviewed, Naj, in Nusayrat camp, who's been writing that she's got 3 hours of electricity over 2 days. You can't maintain 20th century life, let alone 21st century life, with 3 hours a day, or I guess the average has been 2 hours a day. It's hideous.
So what is there a campaign specifically? Is it targeting Israel? Is it targeting Abbas? What do solidarity activists, what do they think, you know, is the approach that might change this?
There's a very small campaign at this point. Code Pink has had some nice posters, Let Gaza Have Light, and other people have had other slogans and appeals out there. I don't know if there's been any demonstrations. Alice Rothschild, Dr. Alice Rothschild, just had a powerful article in an American news site. She's a doctor. She's been to Gaza, and she knows what happens to hospitals when there's a cutback in electricity. And hopefully this will galvanize some interest.
I mean, there are a lot of solidarity groups in the U.S. And also, you know, groups in Israel that are against the occupation and would support an end to the blockade. Do you see this as a time of, and maybe it has to do with the election of Trump and people having their hands full in the U.S. with so many other more immediate issues, does it seem like it's more of a lower level of activism around this issue or not?
Well, it seems like a low level of activism around Gaza. I had expected much more. I mean, it's sad, you know, you almost have to see a massacre. I mean, just 3 years ago was this hideous war against Gaza. You know, then that started up. People got into the streets. They did things. You know, it's different. It's not as obvious. It's an experiment, as Gideon Levy has said.
So this is your 700th show, and how many years have you been doing this?
We've been doing the struggle since 2003.
The Middle East Crisis Committee has been around even longer, 30 years or something, is that right?
More than 30, 35. This would be our 35th year. Wow. Come September.
Over those years, do you see, like, everything's sort of the same, or do you see ebb and flow? Do you see different issues coming to the fore over the years, or maybe reverting to certain issues as time goes on? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, it's kind of gotten worse and worse for Palestinians. On the other hand, there's been definite changes in America, particularly among U.S. Jews. You know, it's as if the non-Jews are afraid to touch the issue unless a significant amount of American Jews say it's okay. And that has happened over the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, particularly with this group Jewish Voice for Peace, which has a local presence in New Haven, and it is a big national organization now. And that has opened up, let's say, permission for the non-Jews to understand things and see criticism of Israel doesn't necessarily be anti-Semitism. The struggle started about Palestine and moved on to Iraq during the sanctions. There's a lot of environmental news, and things are, you know, as grave as they can be with Trump pretending he can muscle Mother Nature. You know, it sort of comes full circle. There was an incredibly alarming article in New York magazine, and one of the sentences just stood out to me, and it said that within decades it will be impossible for Muslims to do the Hajj because it will be too hot in Saudi Arabia to physically walk and do the Hajj. This is something 2 million Muslims do a year. So our issues of Middle East justice and religion and environment are all coming together.
That was Stan Heller, executive director of the New Haven-based Middle East Crisis Committee and producer of the Struggle TV program. Learn more about the power blackout imposed on the people of Gaza and the work of the Middle East Crisis Committee by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Not long after it was unveiled on July 13th, the second version of the proposed Senate Republican health care bill to repeal and replace Obamacare collapsed. A total of 4 senators announced their opposition to the legislation, which could only afford to lose 2 votes among the Republicans' slim 52-seat Senate majority. All of the 46 Democrats and 2 independents had pledged to vote against the measure. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell then moved to a third attempt to make good on the GOP's long-running campaign pledge to repeal President Obama's signature health care legislation. Following the lead of President Trump, McConnell said he was going to move to repeal Obamacare very soon and leave debate over a replacement plan for a future date. But not long after his Plan C was announced, 3 Senate Republicans declared their opposition to that plan, killing the standalone repeal attempt. In its second version, the Senate Repeal and Replace Plan would have maintained the dramatic cuts to Medicaid, assuring that 15 million Americans would have lost their health insurance by 2026, with millions more losing coverage due to higher premiums without subsidies. An amendment by Texas Senator Ted Cruz would have allowed insurers to offer cheaper policies with few benefits and discriminate against those with pre-existing conditions. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Susan Rogers, an advisor to the group Physicians for a National Health Program, who assesses the now-dead second version of the Senate GOP health care bill and reflects on how the current national debate has affected the campaign advocating the adoption of a single-payer universal health care system that would cover all Americans.
This bill is, I mean, it's as close to health care reform as an elephant is to a mouse. I mean, there is no reform in that bill at all. All it does is it decimates Medicaid in order to subsidize tax benefits to the wealthy. One of the misconceptions about the Affordable Care Act is that that's been the cause for insurance premiums to rise, deductibles to rise, co-payments for care to rise. But all of that started way before the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act did not cause that. It may have perpetuated it and made it happen a little bit faster. But this new bill does not do any change to how health care is delivered. All it does is it provides a way to cut benefits, to provide less coverage to people, so that people end up buying an insurance policy that essentially offers them no coverage. There's a lot of benefits that the Affordable Care Act did do, like allowing children to stay on their parents' policy till they're 26. It required some benefits that needed to be included, such as maternity care, physical therapy, long-term care, a whole variety of things that they've now taken out so that insurance companies don't have to provide this. So what it does is it says it's an insurance policy, but it's really not insuring people, because what they've done is to make it affordable, they've deleted the benefits. And then Medicaid, which is a big provider of health care, they've just decimated, and the number of people who are now going to be uninsured is going to be phenomenal.
Certainly, the Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare has focused a lot of national attention on the question of whether or not health care is a human right. And the Republicans certainly, by and large, have come down in opposition to the notion that people have a right to get health care when they're sick. How has this debate, in your view, moved opinion, if at all, in the direction of people around the country now believing that health care is a human right, as it is in most of the other industrialized nations of the world who have a universal health care system of some kind in place?
Yes. Well, PNHP, the Physicians for National Health Program, clearly believe that health care is a right. And like you say, more and more people are believing that, too. But a lot of the country does not, especially the Republicans who are sponsoring this bill. And one of the things that they promote is this argument that the market forces will finally stabilize health care costs and will solve this whole health care problem, and that competition in buying health insurance policies, will the competition itself will help lower costs. But it doesn't do that, because that does nothing to what the market allows things to be, what the market allows things to cost. If we look at what we pay in this country, for example, for a chest x-ray, we pay maybe 10 times as much as other industrialized countries with a single-payer system. Same thing for everything. A cardiac bypass can cost 3 to 4 times as much here in this country. And it's not any better here than it is elsewhere.
Dr. Rogers, how has all this controversy about Obamacare and now this Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare, how has it contributed or not to strengthening support for a single-payer universal health care system of some kind here in this country?
Yes, I think over the years, the numbers of people who support single-payer has increased. And if you look nationally, it is now the majority of physicians nationally support a single-payer system. And I think there's just a lot of confusion about what single-payer is, which really kind of tempers the support that we should be able to garner. And now the numbers, like I said, the numbers of doctors and non-physicians who are supporting single-payer has increased.
That was Dr. Susan Rogers, a retired Chicago internist and advisor to the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Find more information on the campaign for single-payer universal health care by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world.
KBOO Community Radio is always looking for ways people can work with us and support us. KBOO has a wish list, and we'd love help getting some of those items donated. Some things on our list include a color printer, digital recorders, a pop-up canopy, dishwashing detergent, brooms and mops, or services like roofing, plumbing, and electrical work. Please contact station co-manager Delphine at del@kboo.org or go to kboo.fm/kboo's wishlist for more information about supporting your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And this is still KBOO Portland. It's 11:31, coming up on Making Contact. Making Contact explores the aftermath of the ghost ship fire and the battle to preserve live workspaces. And if you, like most people, have already forgotten what all that was all about, that will be covered. So tune in and listen close. This is Making Contact on KBOO Portland, your community radio.
On this edition of Making Contact, we'll explore the aftermath of the Ghost Ship Fire and the fight to preserve live work spaces, and we'll discuss the San Pablo Fire that displaced at least 100 residents, many of whom are now living on the street. That's next on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. It has been 7 months since the fire at the Ghost Ship Warehouse in East Oakland that killed 36 people. On Friday, December 2nd, at about 11:30 p.m., a night of electronic music was just beginning when a fire broke out, engulfing the building in a matter of minutes and trapping partygoers inside the difficult-to-navigate building. According to the New York Times, there was only one exit, and it was down a winding makeshift staircase. The building that housed Ghost Ship was originally built in 1930, before people moved in residentially in 2013. The space had been empty for years. And while housing prices in the Bay Area have pushed more people into unpermitted rentals, locals have been living in the industrial spaces since long before the current housing crisis. The early 1970s saw a wave of artists moving into unused spaces in San Francisco's SoMa and Mission districts. And while almost all of them are gone, some of these old-time collectives have become part of the city's current artist establishment. Here's Jeremy Dalmas with a report.
Instead of ringing a doorbell, Craig Baldwin told me to stomp on the metal plate in the sidewalk in front of his space on Valencia Street.
I'm probably the last straggling, you know, guy in the mission. I'm the leaseholder here, by the way.
Baldwin's lived here at Artist Television Access since they moved in 1987. They're a small theater and event space that focuses on film. Baldwin himself is a well-known experimental filmmaker, and he keeps his film archives in the basement. But before moving in, he lived at the iconic Project One.
Like a four-story building, five if you count the basement. There were 70, 78, 79 people in there, probably more at one point.
According to local historians, Project One was the first community of young artists who lived in an old industrial space in San Francisco. Before 1971, those spaces weren't available because they were still filled with industry. Large-scale manufacturing hadn't started to leave the city in earnest yet. Dozens of artists moved into this 84,000 square foot old candy factory at 10th and Harrison in Soma. Baldwin describes it as a multi-story vertical village with projects all over the building.
Like stained glass or filmmaking or silkscreen printing or music studio. And in the first floor, there was actually a computer lab, one of the very earliest here.
Project One was for people who needed a large space, a studio, but their work couldn't fit into a normal house. And affordability was also crucial.
You see, the idea is if you lived in an apartment and then you had a studio somewhere else across town, you'd be paying two rents.
They would have been paying an average of around $400 a person to live and work there, adjusted for inflation. He says he could never have become an established filmmaker without that physical space. The economics for artists are the same now.
The cost of paying for the gallery space is made up for, see, by the renters.
Hosting music performances, films, and art shows provided a venue for lesser-known talents and, at the same time, helped residents pay the rent. But these spaces rarely last. Project One got evicted in the early 80s, and almost every other industrial art space in San Francisco is long gone. But against the odds, there is one tenacious space in the Mission District that has survived for decades. This space is still there, and they're still relevant. This is a recording of Kronos Quartet performing there in 2010.
Arto is beautiful if you go over there. They succeeded, you understand, for whatever reason.
Project Arto started in 1971, right after Project One. They're in an old American Can Company factory that takes up a whole city block. They began with practically nothing.
But there was no walls, so it was unbelievable. It was just like open into this 40,000 square foot. It's amazing. It was a cathedral.
Nicole Sawaya used to manage the theater here. She moved into Project Arto in 1978 and has lived here ever since. Like Craig Baldwin, she says that having both arts and living spaces in the same building was economically essential. There are still performances today, and dozens of artists still live here. They tend to be older, like Sawaya.
So here's my studio. Oh, God. When I got this studio, I sandblasted, because this was all painted, to take it down to the brick.
Just like Project One, and like contemporary live-in industrial spaces, when they first got in here, it was an empty shell, and they had to build everything themselves.
And then it was like screw guns and sheetrock all through the morning, noon, and night.
For the authorities, though, this was unprecedented. Sawaya says the city had never heard of having events in the same place where people lived. They condemned the building almost immediately. And this would have been the end of the line in other spaces. But Project Arto had an ace up their sleeve, an advantage that few artist spaces had, then or now. They own the building.
And we wouldn't be here if back in 1971, those very, very smart people hadn't said, you know, forget about leasing it, let's buy it.
The city didn't make people stop living there, and Arto worked with them slowly over the years to write new codes and get the building into compliance with existing regulations. It was a back and forth, beginning with sprinklers, fire doors, and exit signs.
But the city was pretty amazing back then. It was very elastic. We were in conversation with them for 10 years.
By 1984, the whole building was legal, and people have lived there legally ever since. And it's not just Project Artaud and Artist Television Access. Southern Exposure, The Lab, and Counterpulse are all pillars in the local arts establishment, and they all grew out of spaces of questionable legality in the 70s and 80s. But as it gets more difficult to use spaces like these, it gets harder to see what will seed the next generation of arts organizations in the Bay Area. I'm Jeremy Dalmas.
In the Bay Area, there's a long history of artists creating community in mixed spaces. But immediately following the national media attention on the ghost ship tragedy that killed 36 people, many artists living in Bay Area warehouses came under scrutiny for their alternative living spaces and worried they could lose their homes. Carmen Brito was one of them. She lived at the ghost ship and lost everything in the fire. She says she was the first person to call 911 that night and thinks she may have been the first person to see the fire.
My name is Carmen Brito, and I was a resident of the ghost ship. I moved in January 1st of 2016. Started a new year in a new place. But before that, it was just so difficult trying to find anywhere to live. I ended up bouncing around the East Bay for a while. You know, most of us are just grateful to find a room anywhere. You know, I was going through Craigslist, and the ad was just, well, one, like the photos were just stunning, but it was just sort of a call for artists and weirdos and writers and people who still have to work and do art and people kind of living on the fringe. And, you know, it just felt like, oh, like, and this is what I've been looking for. Like, this feels like a home and a temple and an adventure all at the same time. I don't know. It's just that kind of thing where it's like, oh, hey, do you want to do that cool art thing? Do it. It's like, oh, you like doing graffiti? Yeah, paint something on the back wall. You know, whatever you're into, do it. I think the first time the power went out was in, for me, it was like the first month I moved in, the power went out. But we had maybe like one power outage for the whole month of January. And, you know, and then they just sort of like got slowly like more and more frequent, like in hindsight. I think the power went out something like two or three times the week before the fire. I'd been at work all day and I'd gotten home, you know, maybe 6:30 or 7. And I see Derek and Micah loading up their kids in their van. And I was like, oh, there's an event tonight. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, I had planned on going out. I had like three things I should have gone out to go do that night. And I ended up just kind of falling asleep. So I woke up to my studio filled with smoke, and I could hear the music going, and I could see this sort of orange glow, and just like my perception of it was that it was a fire, but a fire like the size of a microwave or something like that, like big but like not horrible. And so I put on my shoes and my coat and didn't really think much about it. I guess I just sort of thought like, okay, we're gonna put it out and I'll be outside for a bit and then I'll come back. Like, I guess when I was leaving, I thought I was gonna come back. And I step outside of my studio and I look and I see an entire wall on fire. And I was already dizzy and disoriented and I just headed for the front door. I got outside and somehow I had my phone with me and I started calling 911. If I'm the first person to see the fire, and it maybe takes me maybe a minute to get to the front door, another minute to call, and then less than 3 minutes for the fire department to get there. I mean, you know, that window of opportunity to have gone out of the building was less than 5 minutes. I think I watched it burn for about an hour before, you know, a couple of my friends came to get me. And they were kind of like, do you want to stay? Do you want to go? Do you do you want us to take you away from here? And I was kind of like, I think I need you to take me away because I'm just going to sit here. You know, kind of tried to sleep, drank some whiskey trying to sleep, and I think I blacked out for a little bit, like lost consciousness for a little bit, but I didn't sleep. And I woke up to one of the other people from the warehouse calling to make sure that I had been okay because she wasn't sure if I had made it out or not. You know, I just remember like the Saturday after, like waking up and like seeing an image of my home on Fox News. And I was like, is this really happening? Like, did this really happen? You know, most of the residents spent the day at, you know, Saturday at the Red Cross. And they gave us these emergency debit cards with like $500 on it to go buy clothes. And yeah, because I was still wearing the clothes that I had made it out of the building with. So I was able to stay at a friend's house in Emeryville for a couple of weeks after the fire. I never slept for more than a couple of hours at a time. And yeah, I mean, it's like the last time I went to sleep comfortably, I woke up and my house was on fire. And I just realized, like, I need a home now. I need another home. And I got really lucky that a friend of mine, who I've known for like the last 10 years from my hometown, had a room open up in a house that he's been living in for the last 5 years in Oakland. You know, I had wanted to move into another warehouse, but with all of the attention of everything going on, I wasn't exactly hearing back from people in warehouses, and I don't blame them. I really don't. It was just kind of like a little weird to feel like, oh, and I'm like 86th from warehouses now. Like, you know, I'd rather live somewhere with that sort of space and that creative energy. But, you know, I was one of the first people to find permanent housing again. And quite a few of the other residents have just had to leave town because there's just nowhere to afford up here. About 6 of them have relocated to Los Angeles. There's a couple still sort of hanging around the Bay Area, and you know, around here, it's just even warehouse spaces are getting expensive. At this point, I think if people start leaving, they're not going to come back. They're just going to find a different city that's more affordable. And I don't know, I feel like this is a point in the history of Oakland and its artistic community of like it either gets better or it disappears. And I honestly don't know which way it's going to go.
That's Carmen Brito, a former resident of the Ghost Ship. Events like the dance party thrown on the night of the Ghost Ship fire used to be a regular occurrence all over Oakland, but they have virtually died out because venues fear drawing attention to themselves. Since December, the city has ramped up inspections. The Oakland Police Department started requiring officers to report all unpermitted events. But many who have run event spaces say that if the city wants to regulate them, it will only push events further underground and may lead to more unsafe spaces. Jeremy Dalmas digs into what it takes to get an event permit in Oakland.
Back in July of 2010, Aja Archuleta played this show at 21 Grand, just months before the space was shut down by the city. Archuleta was one of the survivors of the Ghost Ship fire. He had been scheduled to play later that evening. And this performance at 21 Grand was part of the Mission Creek Music Festival, organized by fire victim Kiyomi Tanue.
My name is Sarah Lockhart. I was one of the founders and people who ran the Art Space 21 Grand in Oakland from the year 2000 to the year 2010.
21 Grand was a founding member of the Art Murmur Gallery Walk. Lockhart says that they were the first alternative art space in Uptown. Their bread and butter was music, but they also have visual art, dance, readings, and film screenings. At their height in 2008, they were hosting events every couple days.
The need was there. It's like we could have filled every single night of the week, but we were making money. We needed to work jobs.
After 7 years of events, one night while packing up, they were approached by the police.
And they just sort of came in, took a look, and are like, if we catch you doing this again, we're going to shut you down. And it was like, do I take this seriously? And then we're like, well, what would we need to do?
The fire didn't create this problem, but it did intensify it. And like LiveWorx spaces, event spaces have also been hit with inspections and eviction notices in recent months. Where are we right now?
Yeah, we're in the front part of Quilombo Community Center.
Vandel helps run Quilombo. They're a radical social center that focuses on Black and brown communities in West Oakland. They have a bookstore, a huge garden with chickens, and their doors are open for Domino's games since the city closed nearby St. Andrew's Park.
And then we have this room, but it's our healing space. We have a really large group of people who do massage and acupuncture and Reiki and, you know, yoga, everything.
There really isn't any other space like this. They're different from 21 Grand, but they are beginning to deal with some of the same issues. 2 weeks after Ghost Ship, Quilombo failed a fire inspection after passing them for years.
On the piece of paper that they gave us, it just said that we are not permitted to have public gatherings.
She says she believes their property manager, who had already tried to evict them before, called in the inspection on the property himself. That manager didn't respond to numerous calls for comment, but Dell says he showed up with the fire inspector and afterwards told Quilombo that their lease was void because of the failed inspection.
We came to the conclusion landlords were snitching on spaces that they knew weren't up to code because they were negligent.
This is hard to verify. Complaints are anonymous. So it's unclear who called in an inspection and why they did it. At worst, the system can be abused. At best, it leads to suspicion.
People need to be able to trust that the safety inspections really are for their safety.
And part of the Emergency Tenant Protection Ordinance, which is slowly being reviewed by the city, would solve this by requiring complaint filers to leave contact information.
I do think that there is a certain amount of pressure that people believe that they need to prove now, after the fire, that they're being tough.
Which is understandable. There was just a fire. The fire department also didn't respond to calls for comment, so we don't know if they are actually getting tougher. The city is right now walking a tightrope, balancing their responsibility to keep spaces up to code, dealing with a housing crisis, and avoiding lawsuits from the fire. But people in underground spaces are also walking a tightrope of their own, trying to recover from a tragedy while fighting to keep their community together. Everyone is trying to figure out how to handle this unprecedented tragedy. And in a city that is in the middle of a real identity crisis and is also known for doing things outside the system, this fire feels like a watershed event. This is Jeremy Dalmas.
The city is slowly considering the Oakland Tenant Protection Ordinance, but it could be months before a decision is made. Until then, warehouse dwellers are in fear of eviction and displacement from the live, work, and community spaces they've created. Across town in West Oakland, 5 miles from the Ghost Ship, former residents of 2551 San Pablo Ave experienced a devastating fire that killed 4 people and left more than 100 displaced. The irony is that it happened a little more than 3 months after the Ghost Ship fire. And although city officials may have learned a lot from the Ghost Ship, residents of the West Oakland building believe the city wasn't fully prepared to deal with another fire-based tragedy that would leave a great number of people without homes. I wanted to find out what happened in the aftermath, so I went to the scene of the fire to speak with former tenants.
That's my apartment right there. Well, I guess the fire started right here. So up there, look, I'm talking about, did nothing make that, nothing. And man, it's crazy that the dude up under me, though, of all people, who would think, you feel me, a candle on a styrofoam cup, allegedly, I don't know. But I lost everything out besides my life up in there, but this guy made it up out of there.
That's Tremaine Trey Baker. We're standing in front of what he used to call home. The building is boarded up now and surrounded by a metal fence. In the early morning of March 27th, a fatal 4-alarm fire killed 4 people and rendered many others homeless.
For many of the former residents, this transitional housing was a second chance to start over again and create community.
See, this is a building for place for people that used to live in the streets, like some have some mental issues, some have drugs problems. This was actually like a residential, community-based place. This like housed a lot of people. This kept a lot of people off the streets. You know what I mean? And I know I was thankful for it, you know what I mean?
Since the fire, with no money and no support, Trey is back to living on the streets, which is a bit surprising considering that each household under the city's code enforcement relocation program should have been allotted $6,500 to help with relocation. Jonas Strauss, the executive director of the Oakland Warehouse Coalition, explains.
The code enforcement relocation program it's a section of Oakland Municipal Code, I believe it's section 15, that basically dictates what happens after a code enforcement action, i.e. a red tag after a fire. A red tag says you can't live or work in the building or do anything until the effects of the fire are mitigated. And so part of Section 15 of the code is a mandate that the owner of a building is required to pay out a certain amount per tenant, depending on what the living situation was, you know, number of bedrooms, number of residents, et cetera, after a fire. And so there's some guidelines around the amount of time in which that needs to happen. But oftentimes, because after a fire, an owner is mostly just concerned with getting money out of their insurance company, it falls into the lap of the city of Oakland to requisition those funds from the owner. And then give it to the tenants. But it actually happens in reverse. And so the way that it happens in a de facto sense is there is a code enforcement relocation program fund. And so that money starts around $6,500 for a studio and goes up around, I forget, $12,000 range.
Jonah believes that the city of Oakland was responsive to the needs of the residents at first, but later dropped the ball on the disbursement of funds.
The city of Oakland actually did a pretty good job of coming down to the West Oakland Youth Center and understanding what the situation was. You had a high-level assistant city administrator. You had the head of housing down there. The mayor herself came down there and sort of made an attempt to talk to folks. And so there was this show of support, but the way that the code enforcement relocation program funds were managed afterwards was sort of a mess. There was an over-reliance, my understanding is, there was an over-reliance on the Red Cross list rather than simply talking to the community and just really establishing who actually lived there at the time of fire. And from my records, and this is incomplete, so I think the number will raise, but there's definitely at least 15 people who did not receive their code enforcement relocation program funds in any way, shape, or form. And the story of how those funds were not delivered actually is rather frightening. And then the end result of it was that they didn't keep accepting applications. They didn't keep doing their due diligence and determining whether or not people lived in the building. Rather, what they did was they just stopped accepting applications. I heard a story about somebody's application getting torn up because the woman didn't like the way that his case was being presented. I mean, this is like, again, it comes back to this endemic racism and class warfare where you have people who are put in a position where they don't necessarily know how to advocate for themselves, and there's nobody to advocate for them.
I spoke with Alex Perry, a former resident and house manager at the San Pablo building. He's currently living in a motel with his wife and children. His wife received relocation funds, but Alex didn't, even though they lived in different apartments. Alex says the money that his wife received is barely enough to keep them from being homeless.
My apartment is 311, but my wife was in 318 with both of the kids. And I don't know if that's how it go or what, but they gave her relocation funds, and I guess they put us together. So I guess what they gave her was supposed to cover my stuff, but I don't see how. I mean, I believe I probably had, I know God do things for a reason, and I'm just, you know, accepting it as we go. But at the present moment, we was told that we was going to be based on a few lists or whatever to find living. But the cost of living and just the way everything is in the Bay Area right now is, I guess, bad. Or maybe the people even just told us that just to get us out the way. I don't know, but at first we was at the shelter, Then we went to motel rooms, and in the beginning they was paying for the motel rooms, but as of lately, like the last month and a half, 2 months, the relocation money that my wife got been going for us to have a place to stay. So we've been motel, you know, just trying to wait it out. We then went, you know, to a few different little places and signed some paperwork for, you know, housing here, there, and everywhere, but we ain't heard nothing as of yet, so.
This perfect storm of skyrocketing rents, shrinking public benefits for the poor, and fewer landlords accepting Section 8 housing vouchers is pushing longtime Bay Area natives like Alex and his family into dire situations. With the recent Oakland fires causing displacement and bringing attention to the housing crisis, all eyes are on Oakland elected officials for solutions. For Making Contact, I'm Anita Johnson. And that'll do it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to KLW and Jeremy Dalmas. If you're still trying to wrap your head around warehouse living spaces, or if you have questions about the lasting effects of the Ghost Ship and San Pablo fires, reach out to us at Making Contact or share this episode with friends and talk about it. Just visit our webpage where you can download this episode and past shows. You can also subscribe to our podcast or follow us on Twitter at radioproject.org. Lisa Rutman is our executive director. Producers include Anita Johnson, Marie Chat, Monica Lopez, and RJ Lozada. Audience engagement and web director, Sabine Blazin. Development associate, Vera Tykolsker. And I'm Anita Johnson. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
And this is KBOO Portland.